Welcome to D3, the Digital 3 podcast, a podcast about the frontier technologies that are fundamentally reshaping the economy and society. My name is Chris Byrne, and I'm the Director of Digital 3 at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. Digital 3 brings leading researchers, students, and the public, private, and non-profit sectors together to build the next economy. This is our first episode, recorded on 20th November 2023, and I'm excited to introduce my first guest, Dr. Aaron Lane, my colleague at RMIT and a senior researcher at the RMIT Blockchain Innovation Hub. Today, we're going to be talking about regulation, public policy, and cryptocurrency.
Chris, it's a pleasure. Good to be with you.
Aaron, I thought this would be a good topic to open up with, because obviously both of us have spent a lot of time thinking about the public policy stance of the Australian government and the US government and governments around the world in blockchain and cryptocurrency and so forth. And we'll talk a little bit about what the Australian government particularly has done in recent weeks. But I wanted to step back and think about this from a digital economy perspective. So the sort of things that D3 thinks about. The big question that I want to ask you is, well, why would we regulate crypto and blockchain at all? How should we step back and think about the purpose of regulation or the purpose of public policy in this frontier technology?
I think this is the question that really we've been grappling with for a better part of a decade, really, not just in this country, but right around the world. I think where the challenge lies is that we've got an existing financial services sector that is heavily regulated. And it's been that way for decades and decades and centuries, even. You know, I know, Chris, you know, your doctoral research was on prudential regulation in banking. And so that.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it as well.
I just have to plug your PhD research. But look, that's the fundamental problem, that we've got this existing kind of financial sector, and we've now got this new kind of emerging technology that is being built in a decentralized way. And people are interacting with that system directly. Now, while that is sprung up in a separate place, these things are now being integrated. You know, when the Bitcoin white paper was launched and the Bitcoin blockchain was launched, people were interacting in that system kind of on its own. Over time, what happened is that people wanted to move value from one system to another. And that's where the tension lies, that we've got this incredibly regulated system on one side and we've got this, you know, quite radical system on the other. And how do we bridge that? And what are we doing on the off-ramps and the on-ramps? So if people want to take assets from their highly regulated structures and bridge those into crypto assets, putting money into that system, how does that happen? And how should society, governments facilitate that happening, those transactions? So that's the problem as I see it, that we've got this legacy system on one side and we've got this incredibly new and autonomous and decentralized system on the other side. And the regulation problem is, how do we manage that bridge?
So I guess that's a really interesting way to frame it, that it's about the interface, right, between regulated traditional financial system and unregulated crypto. There's two real responses that I guess you see to that claim. First of all, from the sort of crypto anarchists and the libertarians, which is, well, why on earth would we assume that we need to regulate this at all? It's designed to be unregulated. Alternatively, from other parts of the sort of pro-regulation side, well, why would we assume that anything is unregulated in society? I mean, regulation is there to achieve lots of different social goals and to provide protection and against market failures and so forth. I mean, so how do you sort of see that? I guess it's an ideological split in the conversation about whether we should be regulating crypto on the basis of traditional regulations or at all?
There's an ideological split in the sense that, and it's not really a political ideology, it's something else, where there's this perception that, hey, what we're doing in the crypto space is we're regulating through code, And we're regulating through social norms, and we're regulating through markets. We're not regulating through, you know, capital L law. That's sort of one way of, I think, seeing it. And there's some absolute truth in that, in the sense that behavior is being regulated in those ways. The flip side, though, is that the law applies regardless of how people are sort of operating. And so from my point of view, it's an enforcement problem. And what I mean by that is that where we've got these highly centralized markets, take Australia, for example, we've got four big banks, got a few other second-tier financial services institutions, and then the rest. But the market is dominated by big players. And it's pretty easy in that sense, from a regulatory perspective, to identify who the regulatory targets are. They've all got names, company headquarters. We know where to look for their executives. Some of them are listed on the stock market and those sorts of things. So as a target of regulation, they're very easy to find. On the flip side, in the crypto space and digital assets more broadly, you can have individuals that are operating, and they're also doing that not necessarily anonymously, but with pseudonymity. And so the target of that regulation, we can point to an individual that's operating in that environment, but it's harder to track them down. We don't necessarily know where they're located. We don't necessarily know who they're operating with. That's the separation from, as I see it, as that, yes, all that sort of stuff where people are saying is it, code is law. Okay, sure. But law is law too. And the law is law problem is not just, does this law apply? Because that's a problem and one to be figured out. But also, can the law reach that person? Can the regulator take action? Can an individual, I think this is often part of the discussion that gets missed, is can an individual take action against another individual? You know, can we find them? So I understand that kind of intellectual divide, the ideological divide that you talk about, but from my point of view, it's more of an enforcement divide in those two environments.
So, I mean, that's a great segue into what the Australian government is thinking about this, of course. So in October, the Australian Treasury released a fairly significant, I think, paper called Regulating Digital Asset Platforms that is basically announcing the current Australian government's perspective on what to do. There's been very little cryptocurrency regulation or very little cryptocurrency public policy in Australia since Bitcoin, outside some areas like taxation. And this, from my reading, seems to be the big announcement. This is what the Australians are going to do about crypto. Why don't you talk us a little bit about where this document came from and some of the high levels about what they're recommending?
Absolutely. Really keen to get into that. But can I just push back a little bit on the character? And this goes back to my earlier point that law is a law and the law will continue to apply even to new activities. Now, in a lot of the, say, consumer-facing space, we have laws of general application. So a famous one is that a person cannot engage in misleading and deceptive conduct in trade or commerce. That finds itself in the Australian Consumer Law. For financial services, it finds itself in the ASIC Act. There are similar provisions in the Corporations Act. So that applies in various different contexts, but it's a general rule of application. That applies equally to, say, a cryptocurrency exchange, whether you're interacting with someone else in even using smart contracts or whatever the situation might be. that law applies in Australia. So that's the starting point, is that we didn't need a specific law to say, hey, you can't engage in misleading and deceptive conduct, just to use one example, in cryptocurrency or digital assets or crypto asset space. We didn't need a law that says that because it already applies. That was the starting point in Australia. And I actually think that was a sensible starting point. And so what we got from regulators like ASIC was to say, look, if what you're doing looks like an offering of shares, we're going to regulate it like that. If it looks like a managed investment scheme, we're going to regulate it like that. If it looks like a derivative or an options contract, we're going to regulate it like that. I think that's actually an incredibly useful starting point. Time has moved on, right? So we're talking about 8 years ago now that those sorts of guidance papers were being put out. The reason I think that's sensible is because what we didn't really want was some sort of blockchain act or crypto act that boxed the technology into doing one type of specific function. We've seen a huge amount of innovation over the last 8 years. And I think there was a real risk at that time of boxing the technology in. However, as things have passed, we've got a sense now of the use of this technology, how it's being used, and how it's being used by Australians. And we've got to the stage now where we do need some changes, and we also need, well, there's a perception that we need some changes along the consumer law sort of lines. So the previous government, there was a Senate inquiry led by Senator Andrew Bragg that looked into crypto assets in the context of, and it was called Australia as a financial and technology center. In other words, it was an inquiry into how can we make Australia the most attractive place to bring in financial services, and including in that crypto assets. That came out with a number of recommendations. The federal government, the previous federal government, endorsed many of those. There was a Treasury consultation process that had commenced, and we're going down this pathway of really licensing for cryptocurrency exchanges. That was the key regulatory problem that kind of fell out was, hey, we've got all these crypto exchanges. There's about 400 operating in Australia. There's no additional licensing that would otherwise be required if you were operating, you know, a money transmitting business or something like that. There was a change of government in 2022, and there was a bit of a pause, but that has been, I guess, revived most recently in October with the launch of really a Treasury discussion paper that puts out a proposal that digital asset platforms will be required to hold an Australian financial services license. That's really where we've got to. And of course, the devil is in the detail. And that's really the history of where we are. We started out with just saying, all right, general rules. And over time, I think, you know, it's really coalesced around this need for licensing for centralized digital asset platforms.
Yeah, let's lightly dive a little bit into that, if you don't mind, Aaron. So what is a digital asset platform? Because that's obviously, that seems to me, at least, to be the policy innovation that the Australian government is wanting to implement.
Well, I talked about on-ramps and off-ramps before between traditional financial systems and crypto asset systems. And that's really what this regulation is targeted at. So a digital asset platform at the moment, Treasury are defining that as the business model shared by the intermediaries responsible. And that is a multifunction platform that holds assets for customers. So what they're really talking about is places where you're putting Australian dollars in and you're getting some sort of crypto asset out, and that those digital asset platforms, crucially, are holding those assets on behalf of customers. So when you go onto your favorite cryptocurrency exchange and you swap Australian dollars for Bitcoin, that Bitcoin is not being held by you in a custody sense. It's not being held in your personal wallet. your self-custody wallet, whatever that looks like. It might be a software wallet, it might be a hardware wallet. Not your keys, not your crypto, right? And it is the digital asset platform that holds those keys and has the ultimate control over that crypto asset. So that's the crucial thing there. So really that includes exchanges and it includes custody providers. That's those are the key targets. Now, I guess the job of the industry now in response to this consultation paper is that's the intention. How do we finesse the definitions and all the technicalities so that it just captures those targets?
I mean, you've sort of answered this question already, but it strikes me that we're a long way away from doing things like regulating decentralized finance, a DeFi bill. It looks like we're a long way away from thinking about how we regulate what we call decentralized autonomous organizations or DAOs, these online communities, and questions about that we've discussed together in the past about, are they like companies? Where does the liability for action lie? It seems like the Australian government is a long way away from that. I guess your point, though, is that that's good. They should be a long way away because they've got lower hanging fruit to deal with first.
This proposal hasn't come out of nowhere. There was really 2 or 3 years that we've not just RMIT researchers, but the entire crypto asset industry as a whole have been engaging with policymakers. And I think there were two key arguments. One, there was an argument about, do we regulate entities, as in do we regulate people and companies and businesses, or do we regulate tokens? And regulating tokens always seemed a bit silly to me because at the end of the day, and perhaps this goes back to the earlier discussion about code, you know, tokens are computer code and they represent something, sure, but what they represent can change. And the functionality can change over time. And so what a token might be launched as a year down the track could be completely different depending on the underlying platform if that changed. And that's a great thing. But gee, it makes the regulatory reality pretty difficult. So I think there was a real possibility at one point that people were talking, hey, we're going to regulate tokens. The argument's been won on that. We're regulating people and entities because it's people and companies that have rights and obligations, not tokens. So I think that was a nice sort of public policy win. The second argument being around, okay, what do we do? What's achievable? And there's, I guess, a spectrum. Do we try and do absolutely everything? Do we regulate the entire universe, or do we do what is kind of the priorities? And, you know, my own view is that regulating DeFi, regulating in that space is pretty difficult. And it's also not a priority because what you don't have is complete amateur investors in the DeFi space. You've got to have a decent level of knowledge in the crypto asset world to be able to engage in these products, in these services, in that environment. And it's not that difficult, but because that there is a little bit of a knowledge barrier to entry, we don't see a lot of retail mum and dad kind of investors getting into that space. So I think from a policy point of view, the priority is not there. It's in these centralized digital asset exchanges. The other public policy risk, and this is why that there's a focus on custody, you've essentially got self-custody while you've got control over your assets. If you might stake assets, you know, with a particular platform, that's got some intricacies in it. But fundamentally, you have a lot of autonomy, if not complete autonomy, over your assets. In the centralized environment, as we mentioned before, it's the centralized cryptocurrency exchange or the custody provider that has custody of those assets. And that creates incentive problems. It creates the types of incentive problems that have led to the collapse of exchanges like FTX, but also you've had exchanges that have gone bankrupt, not because of any wrongdoing, but because it just wasn't a profitable business. and you've left consumers stranded in those sort of insolvency situations. So I think from a public policy point of view, you have a lot stronger rationale to, put a framework around these centralized exchanges, because one, the policy need is there, but also because it is achievable. And so I think what we're seeing with this proposal, despite the fact that there are some down in the weeds stuff that might capture DeFi, but setting that aside, that the fundamental premise of the paper, the discussion paper from Treasury, is let's look at licensing for these centralized platforms.
And so it's hard to talk about crypto and blockchain in anything but an international context, because blockchain is a technology that's born global. It exists literally in every country. It's accessible, depending on the on-ramps and off-ramps that you've described, it's accessible to those in any country. It can be moved across international borders or virtually instantaneously, certain faster than traditional financial flows. How would you read the international environment generally, and where does the Australian public policy framework fit into global competitiveness?
There are a number of jurisdictions around the world that are, having the same sort of policy discussions, and some are moving fast and some are moving slow, and different jurisdictions are doing it differently. So, that's the first thing to say, is that we're all on a journey here in some respect. The second thing to say is some of the international concerns have already been dealt with in anti-money laundering legislation. So a number of years ago now, Australia saw changes to the anti-money laundering counter-terror financing legislation that required cryptocurrency exchanges to register with AUSTRAC, that unlock a bunch of obligations for cryptocurrency exchanges in terms of money laundering, and that really means doing due diligence on their consumers and reporting any suspicious transactions and those sorts of things. So I think from an international sort of sense, some of that is there. That cooperation is already there for international law enforcement, for instance. So I guess that international cooperation is kind of being dealt with. I think what's left now is domestically, each sort of jurisdiction is kind of competing, and they're doing it in their own way, and they're going to do it in their own system. But key leaders out of the blocks, I think, have been jurisdictions like Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan. Most recently, we've seen other big financial centers that you would think of in the United Kingdom make some strides towards what they're doing in the European Union. We've seen the passage of what they're calling MiCA, or markets in crypto asset regulation. So that's kind of uniform rules for the EU, and then each EU jurisdiction will then go about implementing in that way. The leader out of the blocks in the EU in terms of implementation and bridging licenses before MiCA kicks off has been France, based on the feedback that I've got from industry. And then you've had this real stop-start process in the United States, where it seems like legislation in the US Congress will make all these strides, and the momentum seems to build, and then something kind of happens that sort of derails the process. It's a bit of a different legislative system there, and so there are differences into how that's contributing, I think, to the conversation there. The other thing that's interesting in the US is, yes, you have kind of the same discussions around licensing, but that tends to be at a state level. New York, what the people refer to as the BIT license, and California have recently come up with their answer to that. It's a bit more business friendly, if you like. But the licensing tends to happen at a state level. At the federal level, we're more concerned with securities, is crypto a security or not? And there is competition in the US between two big federal regulators about who gets to regulate this stuff. And we've got the Securities Exchange Commission, the SEC, on one side, and we've got the CFTC on the other side, who typically regulate commodities. So we've got sort of this securities versus commodities war playing out between different federal regulators in the US. So lots of interesting sort of stuff going on there, and everyone's running their own race a bit. And I think definitely the differences in the lawmaking process is playing out as well.
Australians don't really, or Australian governments don't particularly like to invent new things. So to what extent do you think that what we've seen over the last decade in Australia is a reflection of a uncertainty about where the United States is going to go? Ultimately, Australian public policy is probably going to align to where the US lands. And given that the US seems to be sort of everywhere or nowhere, that's created all sorts of domestic problems for us.
Senate inquiries and other sort of hearings. One of the questions that you'll get asked is, what's happening in the EU, or what's happening in America? You know, can we adopt that? And my answer to that is always, look, we've got to move because they're moving. Crypto assets are a global first, and people are going to position themselves where it's best for them. And we want to make sure that we're retaining Australian talent and making sure that they're not going offshore. Because that's good for our kind of industry here. And also, hopefully, attracting even more talent to come. And so I've never been a person that's thought we can just pick up another country's thing off the shelf and implement it here. What we can do is just look around and see what approach people are taking on the big questions. So those big questions are, who do we regulate? Why are we regulating? You know, what specific harms are we seeing, and what actual harms are there versus just hypothetical harms? And how are people going about that in terms of definitions and those sorts of things down in the weeds? Now, I think it's the big questions that should shape Australia's thinking, not the small questions about, you know, which regulator should it sit with, and what agency do you need to apply for a license for, and all that sort of stuff is not going to be relevant to Australia. It's the big questions that matter.
I mean, I take that point, but I think one final thing I'd like to cover in our conversation, Aaron, is something that I know that you've done a lot of work with, both in your academic research and as a lawyer, which is the really significant problem of financial scams in the economy. And so it's all well and good for us to argue that we need to be competitive and we need to start blockchain companies in Australia and we can attract jobs and so forth. But I guess my reading anyway is that from the federal government's perspective, all of that is drowned out by a really substantial problem of financial scams, some of which have to do with crypto, but in fact, at least in my understanding, the majority which do not, but is really a substantial consumer harm problem that politicians are hearing about when they go to fetes and when they go to community functions. You know, my brother was scammed here and there. I'd be interested in your thoughts about what the government's perspective is on the scam problem, whether I'm reading that correctly, that it is a problem of significant harm, and how we would go about tackling scams, whether they're crypto or otherwise.
It's a great question, and it does capture, I think, a lot of attention. And look, probably rightly so, in the sense that not only is it significant in terms of dollar value, you know, we're talking hundreds of millions on a global level, billions that are being really taken from people. It is taken. It's really sort of financial theft in a way. It is a real problem. And there's two sort of issues, I think, for how the industry sort of respond. One is that I've seen people play down that response and sort of say, no, it's not an issue. Crypto gets a bad rap, but, you know, this is kind of the fear, uncertainty, doubt thing. Don't pay any attention to it. I actually, when I hear those arguments, I think that the industry does itself a disservice, because it is a real problem, and it's a matter of how that problem is tackled. Now, the flip side is that perception sort of drowns out everything else, and the reality is that the factual reality, if you look at the data from the big data analytics, you know, companies in this space, is that scams and other illicit activities account for a tiny proportion of the overall transaction volume of crypto assets. So I think it can be overblown on both sides of the equation there. And The other point to make is that while crypto is being used, these are not really cryptocurrency scams per se. Most of them are pretty generic kind of cyber scams, phishing emails, the old sort of Nigerian prince scam where, hey, I've got a lot of money. I need your help to get it out. Can you please pay me $100,000 and, you know, you get $2 million back when I get my assets out. Those sorts of scams we see a lot of. The other ones are like romance scams where, you know, you match with someone on a dating app and, you know, after a few messages, they're talking to you about, hey, I've invested all this money in this different investing platform and, you know, you just need some crypto to get started and that's how you onboard. And then you get the investment scams, which are not necessarily crypto related. They're like, hey, I want to invest in options or contracts for difference. And the way you do that is they accept cryptocurrency as payment. And you pay all this money in and it looks like a legitimate platform, but actually it's just a big scam. The reason why the scammers are using crypto is because it's global. You take that money offshore immediately and it's out of Australia. It's not going through a series of different financial intermediaries. So the scammers are using the benefits, I think, of this technology. It's a real challenge. It's a challenge because the perpetrators are difficult to locate. It's a challenge because the funds are immediately outside of the jurisdiction. And for individuals, that means that it's hard to chase the perpetrators. It's not worth bringing legal action in Australian courts. On the flip side, when you've got the regulators that are, whether it's ScamWatch, the ACCC, whoever it might be, their job is not to recover assets for consumers. Their job, whether it's law enforcement's job, is to lock up bad guys. And if there's no bad guy in Australia, that they don't have a lot of motivation. From the regulator's point of view, their job is really to educate people about these things. They don't really have much control over it either. So it is a problem. It's a problem that needs to be tackled. And I think it's incumbent on industry to pay a little bit more attention to that problem and can, whether it's exchanges or custody providers, what mechanisms can they put in place to assist their consumers? And a lot of them do, by the way.
Yeah. So from a high level perspective, I think there's obviously some mechanistic things that financial service providers can do, which is just careful monitoring of suspicious transactions and so forth, which they do a lot of. And the Australian government is trying to get the banks to pay to really wear the burden of that monitoring. But also, to your point, I think there's just a big education problem that we have discovered in this internet age, in this digital economy age, that there's a lack of financial knowledge about what looks like a reasonable investment, what looks like a safe interaction with funds.
And also that there's no person to call up if things go wrong to reverse your transaction. I think that's the biggest, if people can kind of learn one thing about this environment, it's that. If you send Ethereum to an address, you can't ring up the headquarters of Ethereum and ask them to reverse the transaction. It just doesn't work like that. And so I think that's something to educate people on. But I must say the overwhelming majority of market participants are good players that want to help their customers, that they don't want their customers to fall into these traps. The exchanges that are facilitating, you know, fraud as part of their business model are very few and they don't last particularly long. But the reason to be optimistic, and the reason to be optimistic is that tracing is, I guess, becoming more sophisticated. And there are a lot of services out there. Forensic accountants, for instance, are getting into this space. Increasingly, lawyers are getting involved in this space. Others are getting involved in this space to help those people that have fallen victim to these scams. So although if you've lost 4, 5, 6, 7 figures on these scams, that's a huge personal cost. I think every month we're making improvements in this space. And that's not necessarily coming from governments, by the way. This is coming from the private sector that is building those tools.
Final question, Aaron. What should we be looking out for the next 6 to 12 months in the crypto public policy space?
Look, I think we're going to be dominated by the follow-on from the Treasury discussion paper in Australia. That's the Australian one. So I think what we're likely to see is some draft legislation in the first half of next year. I think in the second half of next year, that'll be introduced into the Parliament and we'll see some form of parliamentary inquiry. The timeline, I think the government would like, you know, legislation to be passed sometime next year. I'm not certain about that. In any case, there's going to be a 12-month sort of commencement time. That's needed. And the reason that's needed is because at the moment, it takes longer than 12 months to get an Australian financial services license. So look, I think we're on the right track. I don't know how quickly that will move, but that's going to take at least another year, I would think. On the US, I've been paying attention to the machinations that are going on there. As I said, there's sort of fits and starts with some of the momentum there, but there was a bill that was being brought in the House of Representatives. They had some other issues where they got rid of the speaker and there's a new speaker, and that took an incredible amount of attention away from some of the progress that was being made on a bipartisan bill in the House. The main bill in the Senate is the Loomis-Gellibrand kind of bill that's been reintroduced. So I think we could see some US legislation in the next year as well.
Aaron Lane, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Great to talk.
This has been D3, the Digital 3 podcast. This is going to be a regular series. I look forward to seeing you on the next episode. Thank you.